and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker to share on the 30th day is Hugo.
Hey everyone, it's Hugo, I'm an alcoholic. I got sober December 13, 2014. My sponsor is Adam D. I belong to the MA group, and I'm working on set time, practicing the whole 112. So let's just start with a long form. Tradition 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Early intolerance based on fear to take away any alcoholic's chance at AA was sometimes to grounds his death sentence. Membership regulations banned. Two examples of experience, any alcoholic is a member of AA when he says so. So, you know, this tradition is pretty important to me. I came into AA when I was like 21, 20, and I was in jail, and they brought a meeting, and I immediately identified. I was like, yeah, that sounds pretty accurate, but I also knew that I wasn't going to do any of the stuff. So, you know, a couple more visits to jail, some rehab, and, you know, I came in out of AA for a long time. No one ever asked me for anything. No one ever asked me what I did for a living. No one ever asked me how much money I make. No one ever, you know, they passed the basket. No one required to put any money in. No one said you had to do the steps. I wish someone would have. I suffered for a long time. And it wasn't until, you know, the last time I came in where I was completely defeated that I decided, you know, that, you know, the willingness was given to me by a higher power to do all the work. So, to be a member of AA, you don't have to do anything. Anyone can come here. Now, to recover, then, you know, we have a couple of things that we should do. But the point is to leave the door completely open. There are no regulations anyone's allowed in. I listened to the speaker thing of, it was Bill Lovey, you know. One of the quotes he said is, we don't require the new man to believe in anything, to pay anything, or to do anything. He is in AA if he says so. Tradition 3 is a charter for individual freedom. The part I really like from the tradition is like how it talks about, because I think AA, when it first started, you know, like they were worried about what people thought. They were worried that, we're alcoholics. We're like outcasts. You know, no one really likes us. Like, I was kicked out of a lot of places. I was fired from every job I ever had. I was thrown out of every apartment I ever had before I got sober. And, I already felt ostracized by society. So I'm coming into AA, I'm already looking for something that's going to send me out the door. I'm looking for any excuse. My first excuse is the word God, right? Like, I don't want to do the God thing. So if we start, you know, putting up signs and saying, like, you need to believe in, you know, Jesus Christ who died for our sins, you know, there are a lot of people that are going to be, that's like another reason that I just would have been like, I'm going to stay out longer, you know what I mean? And the idea that this program is just, you know, there is a spiritual basis to it, but if you don't need to believe in any sort of religious theology, you know, you don't have to believe in any specific God, you can choose your own God. You cannot believe in God at all. You have to be Gnostics. Like, whatever. Do whatever you want. Now, of course, like I said, for recovery, you know, if you want to do what we do, of course, we have things that you should do. But again, it's just a suggestion. Like, you can sit here and do whatever you want, and you can say you're a member of AA. Now, the other thing that I really, it's the part of the chapter that really sticks out. We were resolved to admit nobody to AA but that hypothetical class of people we termed pure alcoholics. Except for the guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof, they can have no other complications. So, beggars, and a beggar, tramps, like tramps, asylum inmates, and an asylum, prisoners, been there, queers, after a couple drinks, respectable alcohol. Any others were surely destroyed. So, like, come on. Like, who are these people? Like, perfect alcoholics who've ever done anything weird? Like, all of my drinking was weird. Like, I got arrested for indecent exposure. I don't even remember not, like, taking off my pants. Like, how did they get off? Like, if I was gonna walk in here, you'd have to check my criminal record before I was allowed to be a member. Like, I'm pretty sure most of us wouldn't be here. Like, I talked to a lot of you. You're all as weird as I am. So, like, the idea that we, like, who's gonna decide what is a respectful alcoholic? What is a pure alcoholic? Drugs are a huge part of this story. I was allowed to come here and say that I was an alcoholic and an addict. Like, no one was like, you shouldn't do that, you know what I mean? It's later on that I realized, like, no, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'm clearly an alcoholic. It started and ended with alcohol. I have a spiritual malady, and the only solution is a spiritual awakening, you know, through the steps. Also, again, so who's going to decide what the rules are? Let's think about, like, who the authority is here. None of us are an authority. The only authority is a higher power. So, if we're talking about God, what God doesn't have any rules. Like, he created all of us. He's decided that we are all, you know, good enough to be saved. So if we're going by that authority, like, we need to believe that all of us can be accepted. The other quote, the thing from the Big Book, from page 46, it says, "We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive, or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men." So, if we really truly, like, Bill wrote that before he even wrote Traditions. And I think later on in society, there were a lot of times where they were proven wrong. You know, they tried to keep, someone was telling me about this, I didn't really read it or listen to it, but a prostitute wanted to join a group. They did not want her to join a group. They reluctantly let her join, and she proceeded to stay sober and help a bunch of women stay sober. So again, we have no right to decide who is allowed to be in this group or who is not. And we need to make it as welcoming as possible. Again, I spent so much time out there being ostracized by society. I have a long rap sheet. I've been to meetings in an orange jumpsuit. You know, I felt really uncomfortable walking through the world. I am not good at anything. I literally suck at life. If I came in here and you guys started giving me reasons to leave, then I definitely would either be dead or in jail. But instead, everyone here welcomed me. I kept showing up, coming back. No one told me what to do. They just suggested stuff. And eventually, you know, because of this tradition, I was able to come back until I was actually, like, willing enough to listen to what was going on here and do what you guys did.
Idea of what an alcoholic was. And that was not me. When I arrived, I had picked in an outfall, so I heard some of the suggestions. But when I finally called in that June, I was desperate to take oral and on board because I had no other options. I got a sponsor. I found a home group. I totally over-intellected with the whole process of getting a home group until someone was just like, it's just a group. You go to every week. It feels a bit like home. I need to commit in there. Like, okay, I think I can do this. And I started working the steps. My sponsor, my first sponsor, was very much by the book. She was like, we're going to read the book, we're going to go through them, and we're going to do them exactly as it's outlined. Because recovery and healing comes from the steps. And so we did that. And life became more manageable again. I wasn't waking up every morning, lying on my bathroom floor, thinking, I don't know if I can make it in the shower and get to work. And I wasn't getting off the train on my way home from work, thinking, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to drink, I'm walking into a pub. I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to drink, I'm ordering a drink. I'm not going to drink another drink, I'm drinking another drink. Life had become really chaotic, and it wasn't like that anymore when I came to AA. After a while, I managed to get some of the gifts that we get in recovery. So, work was going well. And then they were really busy, and I got really fixated on the idea of getting promoted and getting a better job. And after time, after a year of sobriety, I go to one meeting a week, which was my home group, where I still had a commitment. And not really talking to anyone, not really being involved in the fellowship, or being in the, what we say in the UK, but I don't think it's a phrase, it, in the middle of the bed. You can't pull out the bed if you're in the middle, right? So I wasn't in the middle of the bed. And eventually the inevitable happened. And one day at work, it was International Women's Day last year. I don't know why. We had a drinks reception at work, and it wasn't anything I was planning to do, it wasn't in my mind that I was going to do this, but I walked into that drinks reception and I picked up a drink. And my colleagues were confused and baffled because they don't even know me as a sober person, and I just, this whole spiel about why I was drinking now, just flowed out. I can't plan it or rehearse it, but all these lies, and just can't naturally, right? So I'm there convincing my colleagues that it's time that I drink now. And then I wake up the next morning. Frankie's wallet. Where's my Frankie's wallet? 5 minutes. That was like straight back into the routine, that hangover routine. Where's my laptop? Did I take my laptop home? I don't know. Did I leave it in the office? I don't know. Spent 2 days panicking about that. I wrestled with whether I should call my sponsor and tell her that I picked up a drink. Because I really didn't know whether I should be honest or if I should just try and hide it. And then I realized you can't really hide it. And I was an emotional guy, so that wasn't going to work. And so I called my sponsor, and she asked me to open the big book to a chapter that I always dismiss as not relevant. Which is twice. As a single woman, I don't know if there was anything useful in this chapter for me. And she got me to read this to her. Perhaps your husband will make a fair start on the new basis, that just as things are going beautifully, he dismays you by coming home drunk. If you are satisfied he really wants to get over drinking, you need not be alarmed. Though it is infinitely better that he have no relapse at all, as has been true with many of our men, it is by no means a bad thing in some cases. Your husband will see at once that he must redouble his spiritual activities if he expects to survive. You need not remind him of his spiritual deficiency, he will know of it. Cheer him up and ask him how you can be still more helpful. God has either removed your husband's liquor problem or he has not. If not, it had better be found out right away. Then you and your husband can get right down to fundamentals. If a repetition is to be prevented, place the problem, along with everything else, in God's hands. I didn't read it like that. There were a lot more tears, and it was quite mad. But it resonated so deeply within me, because I was not living a spiritual program. I was not handing anything about my life over. And then the next 6 months ensued such painful hell. I could not maintain my sobriety. I couldn't get sober again. I couldn't maintain days. And the more I tried to control it, the worse and worse it got. And so I managed to get 2 months, then a week, then 3 days, then a day, then a day. And at the same time, my work offered me a new job in New York. Arguably, moving was relapsing. It's complicated. But I did it anyway. And I crashed into New York in August last year. And I've never been more alone in my life. But also, never been so free to accept the program and open to it. Because I had nothing else. I have no choice. It's just me, my higher power. And he put the right people in my path to help me on my way. So one morning, after my last blackout, I woke up to a text message on my phone from a woman I'd met in the rooms a couple of weeks before. I worked with it earlier in the year. Lorraine, who is now my sponsor, asking if I wanted to go to a meeting. And she didn't know I was struggling to stay sober, but she just happened to reach out at that point. And through her, I found AG. And through AG and some of the lovely women in this room and others, I managed to find some sobriety again. So now I'm back working through the steps. I'm currently on step 4. It's more painful this time. probably because I'm being more honest this time. And so if you're new, or if you're struggling, or if you're struggling to keep days, or you've not been able to tell someone that you've picked up again, or you're worried about picking up again, and you don't know how to find that voice, I've been that person. I've been the person sat in an AA meeting who is desperate to get out of the AA meeting and go and get a drink, because I did that. And it was dark, and it was lonely. But you don't have to do that. So I just encourage anyone who's in that position right now to just reach out to anyone and find your higher power to help you through. That's it.
Friday date is July 31st, 1998. You know, and of course I've been thinking about what I'm going to share since Rich asked me. But I'm just going to tell the truth and try to help a newcomer. That's what we're here to do. We're here to do a job. And I was taught that I'm here to create an atmosphere of identification. And I agree with that, because if I didn't identify, I wouldn't stay. And I really love that we talked about tradition 3, because I love that tradition. Many, if that one in particular, if that wasn't there on our list right here, I don't know if I would be here either. Because I didn't know if I was an alcoholic, I questioned that. I knew I was a drug addict, I didn't know if I was an alcoholic. So I would read that and I would just say, well, I'd ask myself, do I have a desire to not drink today? And I would say yes, and so I owned it and I could claim that I had my seat and I belong here. And so that was good. And also thank you, Rachel, for what you read in the big book about I mean, I read that chapter, but not in that context, with my 21 years. And I like how you put in the context of relapse, because I also have a story of relapse. And I really related to what the writer was saying, that when God is ready, God will divinely intervene. And that's exactly what happened to me. So, just about my story, I'm just going to share, I was betting on, of course, I mapped out 15 minutes of what it was like and 15 minutes of what it's like today. So, I had my first drink when I was 14, and I'm not from an alcoholic home, and that was an issue that my brain hooked onto when I was questioning if I was an alcoholic. I kind of would hear all everyone say, and, you know, they're from an alcoholic home, and I'd be like, well, I'm not, I probably don't have the gene, and you know, maybe not. And another thing I learned when I was new, you know, you'll hear a lot that you know, we're uncomfortable, right? So we're looking for anything that will get me out of here. So I'm always looking, I'm unidentifying, you know, and I had to hear things like just identify, just look for where you relate, look for things that are like you, feel like you, things you did, behavior. And that saved me because I default negative, unfortunately, without the program, the tools, and God, and a million phone calls. I tend to default negative, so I really have to work on, you know, looking for the good, looking for what I relate to, looking for what's going to, you know, connect me to you. So that's something I learned right in the beginning. And so, not from an alcoholic home, maybe, you know, some great ground someone is, but whatever. I wasn't raised with it, but I do have it. So. At the age of 14, I had my first drink. I didn't like the way it tasted, but I loved the way it made me feel. And the reason is because I didn't feel. And that's all I wanted to do is not feel. And I wanted to escape, and I wanted to be on the moon, and I didn't want to relate with anybody. And I don't know where that came from. I don't know. And one thing that I noticed is when I started drinking, I reacted differently than other people. I liked it a little too much. And so I didn't have sort of this idea that, you know, like, I hear people think that they didn't understand what was going on. Like, I had this intuitive thought. I sort of knew that it was different. I had to get everything that I could in me because this is going to have to stop. Because I knew that I couldn't do life like this. It took over. And so I lived consequence-free for about a year. And then at age 13, it started coming in hard and heavy. And what that looked like was, you know, going from a good tracks person, good student, to getting suspended from school. Taking my mom's car and wrecking it in front of the school with my best friend to the side, you know, all under the influence. Going to having my mom arrest me and having me in the juvenile system, going to juvenile lockup, suddenly in my first outpatient rehab, making my urine analysis as clean so I could still be high when I was at the treatment, or drunk when I was at the round circle talking about our problem. So I was really going to any lengths to stay out there, and I was kind of just on fire with this disease. And so I remember I went to my first AA meeting, and it was court mandated, and I went to get the paper signed in Salem, Oregon. And, you know, it was just a big blur to me. For old people, I was 15, I got it signed, and I went along my merry way. I put the alcohol down, and I did still smoke pot. I felt like that, you know, kind of wouldn't be a problem. So I kind of lived out my teen years like that, and then had an opportunity to go to Europe and work, and I was 17, and of course I said yes. And due to being in the court system as a teenager, I went to a court school, so during the summer, yay, I earned credits, so I graduated early. And so I remember it was like, you know, time to walk with my class in the graduation, and I got this opportunity to go to Paris, and it was like, walk with your class around Paris. I mean, no brainer. I was out of there. I got right on that plane. I was 17. I can't believe my mom let me go to this day. I guess she was happy I was somewhat sober, still smoking pot. Anyways, I got on the plane, went to Paris, and I was blessed with a great career there, even though I wasn't really present. I was physically present, but I sure was not emotionally present or any other kind of present. So over there, the drinking age was 18, so I was off and running. You could, you know, put the fake IDs away. I could just, you know, have the party in public, no problem. And then I did that, and I remember I wanted to learn French, and everyone would say, you know, I had great intentions. I would sign up for, what is it, Alliance de Francaise, or we go sign up, and there was like one class, and they would say, you have to get a French boyfriend, and you know, I just never did, and got the American boyfriend, and of course spoke English, and was a major alcoholic. And so we shacked up, and, you know, I was with him, and I was working and I was getting accolades externally. I was in a fashion industry, so, you know, I was getting accolades externally and I was dying inside and, you know, very disconnected, but I was independent because I was making money. So that was a problem and it kept it going for me. It kept it going because I could buy, you know, sort of just pay myself out of it, buy myself out of it. I didn't have to depend on anybody. I could just keep the string going. And I used that in a big, big way. You know, right into paying for all my rehabs and not paying taxes for 5 years. yeah. And anyways, so I was in Paris and I was done with Europe, but I wanted to come home to the U.S., and so the place to come was New York. And I came here, and I didn't have any friends, and I had, you know, my agent, my work, and I came here, and let's see, you know, it was just a little sad. I didn't really have healthy friends. I had not healthy friends. I checked up with them, and kept the party going, just fast and furious, and once I crossed the line with alcohol, anything goes, and I crossed most of my yes, I did, out there. So, anything goes, I'm powerless. And what I learned here is, you know, it talks about in the book that we have mental twists, we have blank spots, and it really, if I can impart anything today, and something that keeps me sober, is, you know, I have to treat my thinking. I have to treat my thinking. You know, once my hand, or once, you know, I'm taking the action to put alcohol in my body, the thoughts are already so sick. You know, somewhere I have believed that this time will be different, and of course that's what I was doing. Step two, I was insane the whole time that I was drinking over, you know, but I didn't have a solution. And, you know, I would do things, I mean, I became a garbage man. I would hang out with, you know, people that were definitely, I was seeking lower. You know, I was in an industry in the 90s where, you know, it was real chic to be drunk and high. And but I still didn't go out with those people. I sought even lower because I was so afraid to show them who I really was once I put that stopping me. Because there's no stopping me. There's just no stopping. So I would not show up. I could, you know, just whatever it took. Once it was in me, I had to keep going. I had zero control. So I would, you know, decline their offers and go to where I needed to go. So that kept on happening, and which led me right into like sort of a rehab tour from age 24 to 28. Lots of treatment centers. I went to AA. I even got sponsors. I even got up to step five. You know, I had interventions. I went to psych wards. I found myself ODing. That was not a bottom. So like was read in the book, it's like whenever God is ready, you know, that's all I can say about, you know, having the willingness to be here. I don't know, it's at some point it shifted. How much time do I have? I'm just going to go 20 minutes. Okay. So yeah, I mean, at some point it shifted. And so, I mean, so just a few more stories of powerlessness. So I would do things like, I would hang out with people, I would sort of gather people. I remember one time I had this person, you know, and he had gotten a wound from being out. I don't know, stabbed, whatever. this is the people that I saw coming out with. And I needed to party like they partied. I needed to drink like they drank. I don't want someone, you know, saying, oh, it's too much, let's go home and put it down. Like, no. We're moving forward. We're doing whatever it takes. And, you know, he would go to the emergency room, come home, he'd have some bottle. And I would just take the pills, I don't even know what they are. Just make me feel different. I remember one time, like, he talked about losing everything, your laptop, and I was a total mess, just a running mess. And I remember I had a trip, I had to go to Europe, where I was at Paris, and I needed a passport, of course. Didn't have a passport, I had to get that in 24 hours, you know, I wasn't sober. I remember I took a friend with me who was on methadone. I saw this big stuff in the bathroom and I just drank it. Like, I just need to feel different, you know, and there it was throwing up. So, like, you know, I would just be a garbage can once I put alcohol into my system. So, you know, in 1998, it finally came to this thing where, you know, my family knew that I stayed in since I lived downtown, that I had been at that hospital and almost died. They found me blue in the face, and by the grace of God, I had a little guy that was with me. Well, he was short, he was a little bit. I had a guy with me who's my angel because he told the EMS, and I was out and woke up at St. Vincent. I never saw him again, but he's my angel because they came in time. And so I woke up at St. Vincent, and I remember crying, and I could see my car from the window, and I was just, alcoholism was just so on me, and I was just a nightmare, and I had no solution and no hope. It was just going crazy. And so I left and I had some medical advice, and I went to my apartment. I just said that, you know, this time I won't mix alcohol with other things. I'll just drink alcohol. So that's what I'm trying to say, is just the powerlessness of this disease and what a miracle it is when we actually get this thing. And it's one day at a time. It really is. And it's weird hearing myself tell my story because I'm so far from that girl. But it's in me. It's who I am, you know. And it terrifies me, but that's why I like to stay in the light. I like to stay in the rooms of AA. You know, you're my people. I feel so comfortable around alcoholics, I can't even tell you. So, and God is here, you know. I mean, we all should be dead. I mean, look at all these beautiful faces, just thinking about, you know, the alcoholism is a fatal illness, it's a fatal disease, you know, and I'm powerless. I think most of you are. So, those were just some of the escapades. So in 1998, my family was scared. They were on the West Coast. I, you know, they had calls, and I remember this one guy down at Perry Street. He was a doctor, and he was in the ER when I come in, and he called my mom. So my mom knew what was going on, and then I would go MIA in the 90s. You pull the phone out of the wall, cell phones weren't as big of a deal as they are now. So I would go MIA, don't want to be bothered, and my family did intervene, and they came, and I was in the house with a character. I had been in the house for quite a while. they come in, and my sisters, you know, through the people, and I let her in, and then it's my mom's stepdad and her husband at the time. And they interviewed on me, and I didn't go willingly, and they held me down. So I ended up in a lockdown psych unit. So I was there, and that's where something shifted. I had this social worker, and she stayed on my case. And in about 8 to 10 years sober, I actually called her and I thanked her. Because for some reason, you know, she wouldn't let me go out and smoke once. She kind of had my number dialed in. And so I went to another treatment center, and that was with Sarah Tucson. So I went from Cornell, New York City, to Arizona. And that's where something shifted. I don't know what happened. I don't know if it was the monsoons. It was July. I don't know if it was the burp sky in Arizona, the tarantulas, the cactus. Like, I don't know what it was. But it was something, you know? And I was out of the cement, and I don't know, God came in, and I felt this willingness, I will say. It was just a true willingness to throw in the towel 100%. And I had experienced AA doing 50%, Lowry 50%. AA's way, yeah, and the result was, as you can hear, not good. So I ended up, and also I kind of like stuck with the winners in that treatment center. I stuck with the winners, you know, people that wanted it, and I was blessed with kind of a larger group that wanted it, you know. Although I think some people were having drugs dropped off in the bushes. I mean, these things do happen in rehabs, quite sad. They do happen. So you have to really want this. You really have to, you know, grab onto the winners and the people that are doing it. So I was in Arizona and throwing the towel and, like, you know, with my history, the therapist was like, you sign this paper and see that you're going to do everything? I was like, I'm good. And, you know, stuff like that, and it felt very kindergarten-y, but my life was on the line. My life was on the line, and I needed a new life, and I was just a little girl, you know. I had just been squashing my life with all those alcohol and all those substances and things, and so I just said to myself, you know, what do I have to lose? I have to lose this crazy life, and so I did, and I became totally willing, and when I say willing, you know, I got completely honest. I just kept no secrets. And that continued on with sponsors, you know, not only at this treatment, continued on with humans. Like, I need to tell sponsors, close mouth friends, just a few, you know, everything. And so then I started like a willing journey, you know, the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was doing it 100%. And I was getting, I only had a craving for alcohol, actually like 2 days. So that really sort of indication, I don't know, for me, that I completely surrendered. Because I was free. I was free. And I started going to the rooms, you know, as all rehabs do. They say, you know, hey, AA is your lifeline. You have to really connect there. And I did that. And I came, and I was in Arizona living there. And I went to AA. And I hooked onto this one sponsor that was younger than me. And my ego was just down. I didn't even care that she was younger than me. And like, today, I'm like, it doesn't matter, you know, it really doesn't matter. This is the solution. It's written in the book, and it's someone that's gone before me who is just going to show me how to do it and have an experience and clean it out so I can live with God, you know, and have another alcoholic. And so I, this woman, she was just looking down and talking about stuff. And so I went for her, and she took me through the steps, and I freaked her out because her story was different. I remember on the fourth step, she took me, the fifth step, she took me to her sponsor's house for like a weekend. It was torture. but they made it loving, and it was, you know, girls. And they made it loving, and we had our tea and our little things, and we, you know, and we did the work, you know. We divulged all and got it all out, and I got direction, and I got to look at my defects. So there was some freedom there. However, I did have my eye on a young man, not young man, my age. that was in the back of my mind, but I still stayed sober. So I went to the, you know, and at the end it talks about the fifth step, you know, go for a quiet hour and see if you've left anything out. And I remember that I think I had plans with him to, like, hike or something. It was in Arizona. So I put that moment on the shelf and went on the hike and then did the moment later. But I am sober, and I did the moment. So, you know, so speaking of relationships, you know, I was new, I was under a year, but I, you know, it was drilled in my brain to make the women and AA the center of my life. My sponsor, you know, said, you know, her experience, she couldn't, like, suggest otherwise because she got into a relationship at 8 years and, she, you know, was working for her. But she was like, look, the women are going to save your butt. It has to be first in your life. You cannot shack up or hold up with a relationship. It'll just take you out. It'll take you down. So that's what I did. And my sobriety was everything I put first, and I still do today. Anyways. That was just a little side note on relationships with newcomers, but yeah, and then I did all the steps. I went through with her. I got my first sponsor, a sponsee, and that was fun. And you know, I felt light around that, and you know, I passed this message on. And so that was, you know, a great sort of 3 years of foundation. I was living in a small town in Arizona, and I stopped my career, and I went to school and. I was working at a hotel and restaurant. I was just doing other things and really focusing on my sobriety. That's what I needed to do. I threw in some outside help in there, did some therapy. But yeah, you know, I think it's great. Helped me a ton. So that in combination with AA and the 12 steps. And then I moved. I left there. Got too small. Broke up with the guy. I went to Oregon to live closer to my family. And I plugged into AA, but not super well. So at about 5 years, I started hating AA, and all of you, of course, and me, myself too. So I started, you know, just like self-loathing, loathing everything. I didn't want to drink, though, because I had this nasty history of relapse, and I just didn't feel, I don't know, it had been taken off, taken away. But I didn't want to go to AA at all. But I was terrified. So. It was at 5 years, so I went to someone who I respected in the program, and I said, you know, this is what's going on, I'm totally depressed, I hate AA, I don't need AA, by the way. And he said, well, do you have a home group, do you have a service commitment, when was your last 4-step, have you worked 6 and 7, and are you helping the newcomer? I wasn't doing any of those things. I was just like half majors with AA, you know, I wasn't in the center. I was just going to observe and, you know, laugh at the qualifications, maybe check out who's in the room, you know, stuff like that. I wasn't all in. My feet were not both in. I was on the periphery of AA. And it was painful. That's a painful place to be. So, you know, if you're there tonight, the suggestion would be just throw yourself into service and do stuff you don't want to do, really. So when someone invites you somewhere, just say yes. And when they say fellowship, just say yes. And make calls to people you don't know. Because all these things are practices for us and for me. And it helps me connect and be a part of the world. So, I have an alcoholic brain. I can handle being alone, in my apartment in a peaceful state for about half a day. And then we need to start moving a muscle, you know what I mean? Change the thought, move a muscle, because my head's getting a little wackadoodle, So in that 5 years, under that person's suggestion, he was responsible for about 6 months. I didn't want to do step 4 and 5 with the mail, just say, because I need to get everything out, and I'm not doing it with the mail. But he got me on a good footing. He got me on a really good footing. And at 5 years, I was just, so in my defects. And one of my major defects was just low self-worth. I just didn't have high worth of myself. And what that looked like, acting out low self-worth, is that I'm better than. That's what it came to. But the truth was, is I didn't have good self-esteem or identity, or know that Barry is a good person or smart. That was a big thing for me because I model, okay? So I was like, people think I'm dumb. They think I'm beautiful, but I'm dumb. And that was just on me, hard. And I was just like, no. I was like, I have to go get my degrees, my PhD, show everybody, So that was an inside job that I've been. He helped me work 6 and 7 around that. And what that looked like was a lot of acting as if, and it looked like memorizing the 7-step prayer. And when I felt the defect come on, which is really easy for me because I started to retract, and just the head was in a massive judgment mode, it was just to act the opposite of that. And think of a woman, how she would act, that is secure, that does have my self-worth. And I started doing that, saying the prayer, and inviting God in, my higher power. And it did shift, and it did change, and I started to become part of it. I right-sized everything. I right-sized comments about my career. That's good, next. Instead of oh my God, they're talking about it. And just making things complicated. I started right-sizing it and getting things, just lighter and more free. Instead of making it all about me. So that happened. I rebooted my program in that way. I'm going to find that, right? And rebooted my program in that way. And I really needed sort of a jolting with the 6 and 7. I needed to learn how to make that work for me. Because I had the identification of my defects in the column ActuBR inventory in step 4. And the 4th column is your defects of character generally. There's a lot of them there. And I need to learn how to shake those off and take opposite action, because that doing that for me has allowed me to live free. And the other thing is, seeking a higher power, seeking God. This program, I just cannot say enough about AA. Since I was sober 21 years, I've been conscious for a while. Because of that, I have sought other spiritual paths, for myself. And this is my main spiritual path, but I align with other ones too. And I have to say that, this one is it's the richest for me, because we are so transparent here. Like I said, I looked at all of you, and we all should technically maybe be dead. And so we don't really waste time to look good. This is how it is. This is what happened to me. This is what I did today. This is what I lied about. This is what I was good. This is what, we get right to it. Okay? The shame is bye-bye. Okay? And and we get right to it, and because of that, there's a closeness that's not in other spiritual places. And I also think because we identify so much with each other, and I can only hear other alcoholics. When it comes to treating my head and my disease, what you tell me, what other alcoholics tell me as well, we'll really listen to. Just retracting, this is relevant to me, so I'm going to say it to you real quick. When I was 15 and I was in that rehab, I remember I had a therapist, and she was trying to help me, and intuitively I was like, are you an alcoholic? Yeah. And she wasn't. She was just a trained therapist. And I'm here. I'm here. So I'm glad that I'm in AA, where alcoholics that have the solution to my illness. It's a great journey here. I'm grateful. I feel like I'm becoming the woman I supposedly God wants me to be, but also who I want to be, which for me is freedom. You know, it's freedom. But I have ebbs and flows. I have ups and downs. You know, and helping other alcoholics and picking up the phone. I mean, I'm so blessed that people call me, and you know, I take the call. And it's like another thing I'll say about AA is, you know, everything that I sort of learned here, I take out into the world. I take it to the work environment, my family, on the street, in the store, wherever. There's just, it's so rich here. Like everything that we learn, you know, we learn to, you know, pick up the phone, help others, be altruistic, show up, you know, do it anyways. Oh, you have fear? Do it afraid. We learn all these kinds of things in AA that if I didn't have, I would really be a flailing person out there. I would be flailing. You know, staying close to AA and tethered gives me the power and the strength by all of your example and by my willingness, you know, by my willingness to make calls and stay in the middle of the herd, in the middle of the bed, or in the middle of the herd, as we say, stay here. In the herd, and it'll be okay, you know, and the way to do that is to have a home group, and it is to have served that home group, have a service committee there, and go to lots of meetings, and call your sponsor, and, you know, and once you've gone through the steps, to stay current, you know, stay current with 10 through 12. I mean, I have to. Myra gets my inventories. I send her my inventories. I do the little mini four steps. I send a, you know, quick 10 on the text, you know, I'm gonna twist, you know. Oh. Who has that but us? We're so blessed, you know, that we can get out of this, you know, and that we have God that's us, because also humans are not going to keep me sober. It says that in the book, my relationship, you know, my sobriety cannot be dependent on humans. It talks about, you know, I think working with others, you know, we can get sober regardless of any circumstance, you know, because at the end of the day, it's really our relationship with a higher power. That's really what's going to, pretty challenging. So it's a lot of, you know, faith. But as I read before I came here, because I was trying to get an AA, get some literature in me, I read that, you know, faith doesn't happen unless you have constructive action, you know, to back up that faith. So this is a big action program. There's a lot of doing. There's some waiting. There's a lot of doing. So I don't know. I can't say enough good things. I'm so, so grateful. And I gave you all a big hug. Thank you.